Today is January 8th, 2018. My name is Deborah Schwartz, and I'm sitting here on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Public Library to talk with Steve Coleman, set designer, artist question mark, and longtime Mill Valley resident. Steve, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with me today. We're sitting in the Mill Valley Library, the bowels of the library, really, in the soundproof room, and you came on a very rainy day. I see you've got your drawing material, so maybe we're going to get a little drawing while we're doing this interview, but I just want to say thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. This is very special to be here.
Steve, your family has, I know your mother, Jean, because I used to see her walking a lot, so I know you've been here for quite a while. You're very much a presence in our community, sometimes indirectly because you're not seen, but the things that you do are seen, such as your beautiful set designs at the Throckmorton Theater, and the vivid, whimsical sometimes, and always transportive art that you, or design that you create, that we all enjoy both at the art festival and in the theater. And so you bring a special color and flavor to our town, and I'm excited to speak with you today. I'd like to know a little bit more to start about your family. If you could tell me a little bit about perhaps your grandparents or great-grandparents, where they were born, where they came from, if you know, and how it is you came to live in Mill Valley.
Well, I probably know a tiny bit more about my mother's family than I do my father's, but they both actually came here from the Midwest immediately before Mill Valley. And I remember my mother's family came because her brother knew, that's Jean, the Wickham family, and they had come to Mill Valley first, and apparently they said there was a great place to come to, so that's...
Where in the Midwest, and what were the names?
From Nebraska.
Nebraska.
Yeah. And so that was my great-grandparents then would have been Louis Spangler and Louise, my mother's mother. And they came to Mill Valley in the 30s, so that's... And I never knew my mother's mother because she died in an incident during the war when she was spotting for planes up on the mountain someplace.
Wait.
In World War II.
So she was eyes on the mountain looking out for aircraft and watercraft, and something happened and she died?
It was just a big storm, and the wind blew in the windows, and I guess she had a heart attack, and it was just a very sudden thing.
And do you know where on the mountain, on Mount Tamalpais, she was?
You know, I think it was more towards the headlands in some place. I've never been up there, but Marjorie Copes actually took my mother up to see the place because she was another spotter during that period, and she knew where it was. And
so there were women sitting in the at the forts there.
Yeah,
at the batteries, or
I don't know. I think there were little, you know, hidden lookout things in the hills, but they were all civilians that did that. I mean, that's, as far as I know, this is all history. That's what my mother said.
Mm-hmm. So her mother died in a storm on the Marin Headlands, looking for out into the ocean,
I guess,
skies. That's interesting.
So my grandparents, my grandfather later remarried, and that was, I don't know.
Don't have to be exactly accurate.
I'm just trying to remember what. Well, anyway, my mother grew up here, and then we, I guess, when, I don't know, I can't even reconstruct. I don't ever thought of what what happened in between.
Well, that's all right. That's what brought your family. How did I get here?
I don't know.
So were you born here in Mill Valley?
No, I was born in Geneva, in Switzerland.
You were born in Geneva, Switzerland.
Yeah, my dad was on the GI Bill after the war, and he was studying in Paris, I guess, and the two of them were there. I guess for some reason they decided to go to Switzerland when I was expected, because the hospitals were much better at
yes.
that time after the war. Everything was just, pretty sad in Paris. So anyway, because my mom did have some complications, so that was why it was.
Do you have dual citizenship?
No, you can't unless your parents are from Switzerland. You can't. I guess maybe in France or someplace you could, but not in Switzerland.
What is your father's name?
Bruce Coleman.
Bruce Coleman.
Yeah.
So Bruce and Jean Coleman, and. Born in Switzerland, and how old were you when you came back to Melbourne?
Oh, they came back pretty directly after that. I think they went back to Paris and lived for a while, and then they came back to the Bay Area. I'm not sure where they... In San Francisco, they lived there for quite a while, and then my dad worked for the Press Democrat up in Santa Rosa, and then came back and worked for the Chronicle. And then he applied for a job with USIS, and then we went to India for 2.5 years after that. So
USIS? What is
USIS?
IS.
The United States Information Service. It was a branch of the government that was kind of like during the Cold War, it was like in a sense, a little bit propaganda, but everybody was... The Russians were doing it, everybody was doing the same thing, but they had American libraries abroad, and they had, he worked on exhibits of American cultural things like that, and he actually worked on the Family of Man exhibit when it came to Madras, and that was, remember the Buckminster Fuller Dome that traveled around the world and had this big exhibition of photography from all over.
Was he a writer?
Yeah, actually, he was trained in journalism. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he worked for those different papers before he...
As a journalist.
As a journalist. And then when they came back to the United States in the 60s, when I was growing up here, he worked for the IJ, and he was like a reporter and had a column, regular column and stuff.
Do you recall the name of his column? No, you didn't.
I blanked out. We have copies of it all over the place, but I can't remember the name.
No
problem. Like Reporter's Notebook or something like that, you know. Mm-hmm.
And do you have any other siblings, Steve?
Yeah, I have a brother, Joe, who lives up in near North San Juan, California. Right. Mm-hmm.
So did you grow up in and still live in the same house that you...
Yeah. When I was growing up, we lived at the same address, yeah, mm-hmm. Right.
Not far from the library, really.
Yeah.
How was it for you growing up in Mill Valley?
Well, I don't know, I guess I'm kind of glad that we missed a couple of the years in the late 50s when things were... I don't know, there was, there was so much, there were years of this real extreme conformity and stuff like that before all the changes happened in the 60s, and I think I'm sort of glad I missed some of that, because it was, it was just all over the country, not just
that
Mill Valley, but...
patriotism, that extreme
Yeah, something,
patriotism.
Something just, I remember getting... I was so little, but I remember getting in fights in the playground at Old Mill School when I was just a little kid, and it's just not my personality, but I think something really changed when we went to India and I got a different perspective or something. But in the 60s, I think it was a very sweet town. It was just a little, you know, more like a village, really. It was I don't know what to say about it. There seemed to be a lot of, you know, there were a lot of European families here, for one thing, that kind of are people that had immigrated. And one of the influences on me was the circle of people that was around Mama Gavander. Her name was, I don't know what her real name was, but she lived up on, way up on Summit, and had a, actually we rented one of her cottages on her property, but she was a Swedish weaver, and she
what was her name again?
Well, I think her real name was like Valborg or something, but they called her Mama Gavander.
Mama Gavander.
Mm-hmm. And she was from Sweden, and she taught weaving. She had a big, beautiful house that was built like a Swedish hall or something, with a downstairs that had dozens of looms, and she had done that for years. Actually, in San Francisco, she had a kind of a boarding house where people could come and stay, and they had Swedish events and dances and all kinds of sort of cultural activities and stuff. And then she kind of brought that to Mill Valley later, and when I was growing up, that's when I knew her. But there was a whole sort of a bohemian circle of friends that she had around her that kind of influenced my growing up a lot, because we go up there for a lot of things. And yeah. we lived up there too. But
so at an early age, you were feeling the spark of creativity flourishing within.
That's one of the people that really must have touched me with. I mean, that, you know, when you're a kid, you just think this is the way it should be, that people are like this, and, you know, everybody like that. And my parents knew a lot of people that had independent presses, or they, you know, they did their own typesetting and everything, and beautiful hand-done books and stuff. And I mean, there were maybe 5 presses in Mill Valley at that point. And I guess my parents knew a fair number of artists, and we didn't know that many musicians. I can't remember that. But, so all those people had a wonderful influence as a child. I mean, you get kind of thing.
When you were in Old Mill and you were getting into the scuffles, even though you're not the kind to get into a fight, I must ask, what side of the conversation were you on? I mean, do you remember what were the things that upset you?
I'm beginning to think I was just, you know, temporary insanity or something, because there's no reason for it. I don't remember. And it wasn't anything political or anything, you know, like somebody insulted family or something like that. It wasn't anything like that. It was just some arbitrary thing. But I just know that my whole personality went through a huge change after India. I mean, that was different.
Going to India, what happened in India? What was that like for you? And how old were you when you were there?
Well, I was in third grade when we came back, so that's all I figure out. I guess it must have been, because I was taken out of kindergarten when we left here.
Mm-hmm. Never so got 5, 6 years old.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then we went and lived in Washington for a while while my dad was training, and then we just went to India from there. But what was the question again?
The question was, how do you remember India? Things, you know, it seems as if you had your experiences there somehow affected you in some way. Certainly you don't sound like you were in the schoolyard cuff to cuff with anyone.
No, never. No, it was very, very different. Well, for one thing, it was the influence that was pretty strong. There was only one English-speaking school in Madras at that time, and it was, so all the kids went there. I mean, some of the kids were Jewish, and some of them, we were supposedly Catholic, and it was a Catholic school, so we got you know, kind of strict catechism and all that stuff, and the other kids didn't have to go to that, but there was this sort of something from that really permanently, I don't want to say scarred my life, but the the fact that you're learning these stories in the catechism class and these ideas about I don't know, all the things I have ever developed about this guilt and, you know, punishment and all these things like that came from that, because the background was that there were, you know, people were, they in India, they don't cover up death. I mean, it's, you'd see people dead in the streets, and you see, you know, they have funerals for children that had died, and sometimes they would kill themselves because they knew that the families couldn't support them or something. They would throw themselves down wells, or, I mean, there were all these stories about things that were happening in the neighborhood, and but all that was out in the open. You know, in America, everything was kind of covered up, and so to me, that was kind of like, this is kind of scary. I mean, there's such a presence of that, and I didn't have like a Buddhist understanding of it or anything, no conceptual thing. All I was just observing was what happens out there, and the sort of sadness connected with it, because things were hard, and you know, it's you know, lots and lots of beggars and people that have been mutilated and stuff, and all that kind of thing that makes you really think about your own perspective. I mean, having come from a culture where everything was kind of so, well, you know, America in the 50s, I mean, it's just, it's kind of an artificial reality or something.
And then you're in the Catholic school with the dogma and the...
Exactly. Yeah.
With the kind of a...
But I don't know. I've never been able to really analyze how it really affected me, but I know that there was a... It overshadowed a lot of the years later. I mean, how I, you know, observed life. I mean, it was just different. But
well, you come back to Mill Valley then, and it's a safe enclave. Mm-hmm. It's things like death are not obvious. That there are places for that. The day-to-day doesn't include those kinds of realities generally.
Yeah.
And, you know, personally, of course, everybody must face, but generally, not so much. So now you're a boy with a certain kind of life experience that, coming back to this bucolic, idyllic kind of existence, and I guess you were a little altered.
Well, you know, the experience in India, of course, was just immeasurable for the, you know, the color, the life, the culture, the music, the everything about it, and the architecture was pretty spectacular, especially mm-hmm. to the eyes of someone that young. I mean, I was just a little kid, you know, and that really did permeate forever. I mean, obviously that was something, and I just, you know, still attracted to the same colors that are just
yes.
way out there. It's I don't have any restraint mm-hmm. in that. And it was just, you know, I guess it did give me some kind of a little bit of perspective on the world, because we, you know, when we went there, we stopped in Copenhagen, and we stopped in Switzerland for, you know, we stayed a week or so in each one, and got some little bit of experience of Europe and the, you know, worlds outside of here. So mm-hmm. even though Mill Valley did feel like a village, I mean, it didn't have that foreign aspect to it, but. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to get the impression that I didn't really treasure the experience of being abroad, because I, you know, we even went to Japan on the way home. So it was getting to go around the world at age whatever it was, you know, and really permanently changed my perspective.
Well, it does provide a little clarity, because when I even think about your art display at the Mill Valley Fall Arts Festival last fall, and the colors of the world that you create there's a lot of saffrons and right. You know, what inspires, what are the impressions that inspire a person's work? It's helpful to know this about you. And it seems as if you were a very sensitive child to begin with. So obviously you were absorbing and receptive to the visuals around you as well as the culture.
Yeah.
So when you came back to Mill Valley, and then is this where you've stayed since?
Well, off and on. I've in the last, well, I don't know how many years I've been, when my mother was kind of ailing and stuff, I was staying with her, because after my dad died and stuff, I've been living here. I've lived in, you know, other parts of the Bay Area and stuff, and traveled, you know, and stayed out of the country for periods of time, but this has been my home most of my life, yeah.
What middle school did you go to?
Well, it used to be Edna McGuire, where they just recently rebuilt that new mm-hmm. school. And that was a pretty scary time. I mean, that's probably the worst part of growing up in that age, you know.
You mean junior high school?
Oh, God, it was a horrible, you know, everything, you know, was so completely confused inside. And it was, in those days, it was 7th and 8th only. It wasn't 6th, 7th, because 6th was beautiful. I mean, it was still here at Old Mill School and fantastic teachers. They were always really fantastic. And it wasn't the teachers at the other places, because I did have wonderful... It seems like all my life I really lucked out with the teachers, that part. But it was that world and that, you know, coming out of that... that time period with all the, you know, the conformity was you really had to fit into a certain slot, especially at that age. It just, and if you did anything that was not, didn't fit in, it's you're going to be ostracized somehow, even if it's only your own psychology that gets affected. But I had some experiences that were pretty awful and not.
It's hard for people today, I think, to understand truly how ubiquitous that conformity, that theme of conformity was, even in California.
Yeah.
That there was, there were some things that were acceptable and some things that were not, and you could be very easily mocked or intimidated by anyone who may have felt justified in pointing out differences. I recall that well from childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes mm-hmm. people were hurt.
Yeah.
There was a time, and even in California, where if you had long hair and you went to the wrong place, you could get beat up.
Sure. Yeah.
And if you were gay, you know, mm-hmm. even in the 60s and 70s, that could be a problem. In the wrong place.
Sure.
You had to be very aware of where you were.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's nowadays, there's some things that, even though there's still challenges, it may be difficult for younger people to understand that things were not so long ago very different.
Yeah, it's funny because I have these sort of shadowy memories of my... my parents are always going to the Tides bookstore in Sausalito and hanging out with people that they knew over there that were artists and people like that, and they're sort of their own bohemian community. But at school, it was this real, you know, the different thing that was still coming. I think it was still coming out of the 60s, and out of the 50s, and then, of course, by the time I got to high school, it started to just break open and everything changed. I mean, that was...
And what high school did you go to?
TAM.
You went to TAM High.
Yeah.
What year did you graduate?
69.
Oh, my goodness. 69, TAM High. So what was that? When you talk about how things changed at that time, what do you recall about being in high school then? And how could you should explain how things were changing?
Oh, God. Well, I mean, the two biggest things that were happening in the country were the Vietnam War and the Civil Rights Movement were simultaneously, bursting out. And I guess it was... I probably, for the first time, things made me at least look at the world as my place and context in the world a little differently than this little tiny, still being in the village or whatever it was that before that. I was developing some kind of social conscience and trying to, going to the peace marches and all the things, and my friends were all very involved in, things for the, either working with the farm workers and stuff.
Oh, right, the migrant workers.
That was a big...
With Cesar Chavez
and all the... They had a major... There were a number of conflicts in Tam at that time with different periods when things were really heating up in the country and the riots were breaking out in different cities where it somehow really impacted the two communities at Tam, which of course were the kids from Marin City and the ones that were from the other neighborhoods here. And so a lot of that was kind of being acted out on and some really bad frictions. And not everybody, but it was just this weird thing because everybody was kind of holding it in and it was kind of bursting out in different ways. And during the period I was at Tam, there was a group of students that got together and decided they were going to do something called Breakthrough at Tamalpais High, and they wanted to stop all the classes. It was just for one day, or I think it was maybe one or two days or something, and have everybody mix the groups of the classes together, and they would just have all day discussions, like seminars or something, and they invited the media to come in, and they got all the CBS or something, they just brought in all these cameras and documented the whole thing, so it put it in a spotlight, and so that it would be more, it would bring somehow the level of seriousness kind of rose.
You mean the seriousness of being in school and having a voice?
Yes, exactly. That's. But again, I don't even really know what the real. It's just a faint memory now. What they did, but at the time, I thought it was a really wonderful way of actually, maybe artificially, but getting people to actually confront each other directly with what was disturbing them and say it right out in a forum that was, not violent or whatever.
It's a youth conference.
Yeah, something like that. It was. But anyway, that was. It was a beautiful thing that they did it. I don't know what it produced in the end, but I think it took a lot of the friction off the situation and there was some violence before and
you mean violence in
at the school
High?
Yeah,
between people with varying perspectives about what was going on.
Yeah. But
in what way were there fights?
Well, they were just incidents. Things would happen, and I don't remember that much more about it. But I just hear the stories of things that have gone down, and it was a very really mixed demographic too, because in those days there were a lot of probably a lot of families here that were white collar, what do you call, not white collar, but the blue collar and white collar mix of people that had, you know, they'd come from other parts of the country and they were a little more maybe racially intolerant, or, you know, they were just different, all different mix. And certainly with the Vietnam issue, it was, you know, really polarized in the middle. I mean, there were the people that really thought it was a good idea that we were there, and the other ones that were thinking it was just the worst thing we could possibly do as a nation.
Well, you are graduated in 69, which means there is the draft then.
Yeah.
And as I recall, the draft was this looming axe over many people's consciousness, for males mostly, and it really galvanized resistance, the thought that you would be shipped off against your will to go fight a war that you may not believe in. And were you drafted? Did you go to Vietnam?
I went through the whole process of the induction and everything up to that point, because I had a pretty, I guess it was sort of mildly low number. It wasn't the lowest group. Somebody was saying under 100 was the more, but it was, I can't remember the number anymore. But I did have to go to the Oakland Induction Center, and everything was kind of set. But I had approached trying to be conscientious objector originally, and I didn't have the religious background or whatever, because they sort of turned me down on that because of the, but so I, you know, because I wanted to try to do alternative service or something, because I really didn't believe in the war at all. And but then I don't know, somehow I just kind of lasted out, because I didn't have a student deferment after that. I was in college, and I dropped out a few times, and, you know, it was kind of back and forth, and finally, you know, the war ended. But I think the biggest conflict in me was the fact that, you know, my dad had been in the Navy, and my uncle had been whatever, I don't know, the stuff, and of course my dad was completely against the war too, but the feeling that the country, you had to kind of like accept two beliefs at once that weren't compatible, that you know, one was defending democracy somehow, and the other was the, you know, being an aggressor basically. But what you were taught was right, or what you thought you'd been indoctrinated in all your life was the right thing to do, is do what your government tells you to do, basically. And this way I was like in opposition to everything that was sort of the way you're supposed to respect the law and everything. And basically I was really in conflict with that. And so it sort of tears you apart. Who am I inside? Where's my true allegiance? And what, I don't know. I mean, and you know, as a young person, I didn't, you know, wasn't that reflective about who I was in the first place. I didn't know.
Yes. It creates a schism for young people who feel but can't necessarily describe why they feel what they feel. It's unfortunate that there wasn't at that time a place for people that were conscientious objectors that still wanted to be there for their country. You know, there were some place you could get involved with, Red Cross or
any
of these other agencies, but legally.
The thing was, it actually, when you got drafted and sent to Vietnam, I mean, it could be a death sentence, really. I mean, because it was pretty, the casualties were so high. And then looking at people that did go from Mill Valley and didn't make it back, and I thought, well, why, what makes me better that I could get out of this obligation and be exempt from it? You know, why do they have to go and I didn't? you know, and so I felt guilty about that too.
Yeah,
you know,
it created a dichotomy. How about the people that went and came back?
You know, I don't really know. I didn't know that many people myself that were, because I had a very small circle of friends here. I mean, the ones that were sort of activists and whatever, that not any of them went. So I really didn't know personally. I mean, I knew the names of people, but
Well, I think you do a very good job of describing the dichotomy of the time for young people, for young men in particular, where you're kind of forced to be on polarized.
Well, and it was even more slightly ratcheted up when there was some colonel that kept coming to the house and trying to get me to sign up and everything before that. And it was like, you know, he was using all the isms and all the things to convince me this was absolutely the right thing to do, and you have to do this for all the belief systems that I was no longer really connected to and all that. I just kept resisting it, but I was saying, well, you know, am I wrong, or is it, you know, is this, I don't know.
How about your brother? Did he go?
He was younger, and I don't remember either. Maybe he had a really low number when he got to that age. Or it was over by that time.
It's something that young people now may not be able to appreciate is the importance of the number.
I can't remember whether it was high or low now.
Fact that when people were given their draft numbers, a draft number could literally tell you, in a sense, if you were going to make it or not.
Yeah.
As in live.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, because if you had a low number, 10, 20, 50, there was a very good chance you'd be drafted.
Absolutely.
And a high number, not so much.
Yeah.
So waiting to get that number was a harrowing time to see where you stood, and then after you'd have to decide how you'd handle it.
Right.
But there was a tremendous amount of pressure for very young people at that time. And the number sort of exemplified it.
Yeah. No, I you're absolutely right. It's interesting to me right now, looking back to how much of it I think I balked out to afterward, because it was so painful being between these two systems, or just believing that I wasn't even, like, to the rest of my family, the other that were in other parts of the country that probably were much more, you know, I know they were politically way more conservative than my parents, and probably thought I was, you know, doing a really bad thing by not serving and, you know, being there and all that stuff is, and it sort of immobilized me too in terms of my own creativity and even continuing with school at that point. I had a personal breakdown when I was in college, so that was something else, but it all kind of connected into that same picture, you know, what was really going on bigger.
Which colleges? You said you went to?
No, I just went to, I started at only at San Francisco State, and then I didn't go back to San Francisco State. I actually just started taking classes at College of Marin, and then just did that periodically for years and years. I never finished anything.
There's a lot of people
that did what I wanted, basically.
Yes, I remember Mouse and Kelly, the artist.
Mouse that up in Sonoma?
Uh-huh. He told me once, this is many years ago, this is not an interview, that he would sign up for the art classes, and then he'd drop out 3 weeks before it ended. So he could take it again if he wanted to, but
if you completed it, you couldn't take it again.
Yes,
oh,
so he liked going to the class, the same class, and
he came to my studio once when there was some exhibit or something he was doing here or something. Once I got to meet him, that was really neat.
Do you remember some of the people that you went to high school with? Because you were there in '69. I know I've interviewed several people who went to school with you, but I don't know if you were acquainted, but people, are there some people that, students that stand out in your mind as your friends or influences?
Sure. I mean, I've, we, obviously, I live right next door to Tom Killian and kind of grew up with him all that period and stuff. And he was, yeah, very influential to me. I mean, at the time, his imagination and everything was always extraordinary. And then, of course, in later years, I really, really respect his work and everything. And that family, they're all gifted. I mean, they're just incredible people. But I grew up, my closest friend was John Leonard and that family. I don't know if you know, he was mayor one time back in the, I guess in the 80s, he was on the council and stuff. And he's the one that did started the Curtin Theater too. We kind of did that together too.
Mm-hmm.
But I was very close to that family, and they really, really influenced me. Because there was, oh, I don't know, I don't know what to say. But it's funny, there are very few friends that I have still that are here. I mean, one of his friends was Ellen Rosenthal, and she's still here, and I get to see her every once in a while and stuff, but really I don't.
No,
not that many people.
So, but let's go on to let's move along the years, and how about we talk about your affiliation with the Throckmorton Theater?
Okay.
Tell me about how that came about.
Well, I kind of was aware. I'd worked at the Marin Theatre Company for a while. I mean, doing series of shows there and stuff, and so I had been working in Mill Valley a little bit, and before that I was always working in San Francisco, and there were some small theatre companies that kind of just get passed around between them, and it was like these little theatre families or something, and so you're still always working for the same people, but about around the time when Lucy bought that, I was here, because I was starting to work more over here. And actually, I was helping work with Ann and Fabio that owned what was Dowd's Barn, you know, and they'd reconverted it, and I was doing some paintings and stuff for them. And that's when I discovered that the theater was, the building was for sale. And so I was really keen to find out who was going to buy it. And when I did find out,
That it was Lucy Mercer.
Lucy Mercer. I went and introduced myself just
walked on in.
Yeah, I just wanted to meet her and volunteer to help in any way I could. And so we just started talking and discovering things, and that you know, we began to evolve a vision of it or something that together. And I had worked on a number of theaters in the city doing, you know, helping them lay out the design and do the interior auditorium stuff for several.
You mean the walls?
Well, the way we laid out the seating and the walls, the configurations of the interior in San Francisco. So I sort of had, you know, number.
You mean you were designing the interior of the theater?
I wasn't an official designer, you know. I was just helping design, but I was responsible for for the way the thing looked. And so I was, you know, keen to be, you know, offer advice in that way if I had. And it was a slow, very slow process of sort of getting to know the building. And Lucy used to let me just go and paint in the big auditorium had windows all around at the top, you know, in the old days, and there was an incredible amount of daylight in there, so it was a perfect place to lay out huge drops, and nobody was using the building at all. I mean, we'd just go in there and look at it for a few hours and snuffle around and try to figure out, you know, how things could possibly be. But she had other projects she was working on, and I was pretty much working on a lot of, you know, other shows, so it was sort of between that. But then she had to do some physical work on the building just to make it strong again and, you know, get that. And she got that done. And then we came up with the design for the auditorium by, I can't remember how it started. I mean, I know I went and looked at a bunch of theaters in Europe of the scale, I mean, that size, and just to get some ideas of you know, the feeling of the room and what we could do with it and stuff and the shape. And I know I went to... because my instinct was to not... Since I wasn't an architect and I couldn't, you know, say, you know, this... Try to pull off some kind of modern design that I wouldn't... I mean, you know, I'm required to do modern design shows when the when it requires a set to be something like that. But I'm, you know, had no expertise. I'm just an admirer of contemporary design. But it also, it takes, you know, it takes an amazing amount of experience and skill and training and, you know, years of knowing your craft to pull off a really...
There's so much
strong
to know.
Contemporary design. You know.
Plus, you have to consider how sound moves
and that as well, of course.
The acoustics.
Yeah, and we did study that, but I, what I'm saying is that I just didn't have the authority to come up with a design that wouldn't become dated after, you know, mm-hmm. minutes, you know, and in time. So my idea was since I'm a, you know, do historic design for theater. I mean, for design for sets. I said, well, why not put it in the period of the building was built in sort of like the Beaux-Arts style was that period, and what would been contemporary in San Francisco to that building was you know, like the time when they were building City Hall and stuff like that mm-hmm. in San Francisco. So that's when I really looked at I was a friend of Dori Bassett, and her husband was had been with Skidmore, Owings and Merrill, and had designed, you know, all the Davies Symphony Hall and the Bank of America and all that stuff in San Francisco. And she'd given, when after he died, she just said, gave me carte blanche to go through his library and find books, because this was the period when I was really searching for the principles of the how can we harmonize this space that had these weird projections out of the walls that were at random spaces, and everything was kind of out of sync, you know, there was no harmony to it at all, no you know, even rhythms in the columns or any, the proportions were just bizarre, and the place needed to be focused into a harmonious whole somehow. And so I went through his books, and I found two, one on Inigo Jones, and one on, I mean, that were the books that architects I'd read, you know, biographies of before, and, you know, sort of knew they were the ones that were reinterpreting the classical designs into either the Renaissance or the more modern periods, and I know they had really studied the proportions and the rhythms and that. So it was trying to extract a pure form from you know, all the the mass of history that you know goes out into different, you know, the mannerist styles. There are all these styles that are kind of not. I don't know how to describe it, but it's like a pure classicism is what I was actually looking for, and I don't know how to describe it any other way. And I didn't want to recreate something that was like a Victorian theater or the movie houses that were just palaces where they just slop on
gobs of gold,
gobs of detail and gold, and abstractly with no, you know, no harmonious proportions or regulation of the. Even the registers or spaces, they go up and down and the sides of the building. And I didn't want that because that was an artificiality. I wanted something that was pure, that if we could draw it from the sources, the original sources. And within that, it would be interpreted to be like Mill Valley and do it with wood, do it something that would make it not, you know, we're not going to make it look like marble or whatever like that. And I'm sure that we found some of the traces of the original theater that just, there are no photos or anything of the original Throckmorton that was, there were little painted pieces of really hand stenciled or hand painted little flourishes on the wall and stuff in certain areas where the plaster was chipping off and stuff. But that was the only clue about the past, and so because we were trying to find anything that related to the original that we could incorporate, you know, at the same time make it all one whole. And so in the end, it was, I just started making the piece. We designed it, and I did go back to Europe, I think, and looked at a couple more theaters that were where they used illusion and you know, you're mixing the real part, the real architectural details with illusionary ones so that the eye doesn't really...
Can't discern, but you can feel the feeling.
And then it sort of leads you more into that imaginary world where you're going to be suspending disbelief and you're watching a play or whatever. And the other thing about the theater, the reason that the design went this way was I really felt we're not going to be doing... you know, like black box productions where it's going to be mostly music. I knew that. I mean, from the beginning that wasn't, and if you're doing a regular legitimate play, you can obscure the, the, all the detail and stuff. You don't have to, you can cover that up or whatever. And it's not, but I wanted a place that would feel good when you're just, you know, just listening to music or, you know how your imagination sort of goes off into the space when you're that, and that feels really comfortable and embraces, and somehow I can't even articulate this right now.
I know it's hard for you.
I can't remember but that was the impetus anyway to make something like that.
I interviewed Lucy last week, and very similarly to you, she seemed to have a super sense of feeling a room. But also not just feeling it, but a vision of what it could feel like. And that feeling, that sense of something that to most theater goers is absolutely invisible. You know, you go in and you sort of take for granted the way something is for us plebeians. But there is, Lucy very much had a sense of how she wanted people to be in conjunction with the performances. And you describe that, I think, is what you're describing right now, that the sense that accompanies a production, that is that it's not just about the music and it's not just about a song and a performance or the people that are up there, but your relationship with the space as well.
Yeah, and it's funny how it also affects the performers, because they're constantly... you know, thanking us for what we did or something. I don't, you know, it's funny, but I wanted to everybody to feel special in there. I mean, that there's that it's a special experience or something. That's and it's, you know, it really only comes alive, of course, when you turn on the lights and you know bring the performers out, and then all the elements connect together, and then bring in the audience, of course, But in it, I don't know. It's just, I guess, because of whatever I've been trained in set design, it was that you're also, when you're designing a set, you're creating imaginary space for the mind to go, you know, like you get this sort of Zen view where there's a hidden, the hidden limits of what that space are outside of what your perception is. You can't, like, walk into a room and just see a brick wall. You create illusionary space off from that, so that there's always a place for the mind to go, and, you know, or the imagination to go, and that's what I wanted the overall design to do too, to be able to lead you, and I mean through your own imagination, obviously, as you participate in the experience, and it's also you're in when you're doing a set for a historic period or a play about a, you know, a family or whatever, you're putting in the the history of those people into the set too. I mean, that what's gone on in this place is somehow included. And I sort of wanted us to feel like we were in a bigger part of history or something, you know, that there was something that we were connected out to, not just to do, like, and a lot of people kept saying, well, why don't you just do a deco design, you know, like, that's the popular thing. And I was thinking, it's too finite, and it's mm-hmm. and it's also it comes from a machine aesthetic that's a kind of a you know, I love it when I experience the real places, you know, like the Paramount Theater or something like that is spectacular. But I didn't have the authority to pull that off, and it's too much only one period, one time, and that you want something that's timeless somehow.
Like you're describing wanting a time portal where any time could come
forward. Oh, that would be beautiful if that's possible, yes.
Where there's a holding space for anything to percolate up and out and unencumbered by the something that had been preceding before. You know, you said that the theater comes alive when the performance comes alive, but I've walked into that theater so many times when nothing is going on the set, and I have always had the sense that the sense of possibility, it's alive. It almost feels like a living, breathing place where the anticipation of the next event is always held. You know, I always feel like something's percolating in there. The possibilities are flitting around. And so it's very alive, even when nothing's going on.
Yeah. Oh, how wonderful that you get that feeling. Because I love what you just said. And it's funny how the building, I mean, to Lucy, too, it was always this, that the building talks to you. I mean, even just before we did anything, it was doing things like that. It was just at dusk, and the side door was open to the parking lot in those days, and I was looking back at the back wall of the theater, and I could see this little curve of that looked like the edge of a screen or something, you know, in the back wall, in the plaster. And I went and looked at it, and I scraped off some of the stuff, and it turned out that was part of the original silver screen that had been in the original, you know, it was like a Nickelodeon theater or something behind where they used to do these sort of like tableaus and whatever they did sort of vaudeville things between films. Mm-hmm. And then I went around and I found the other four corners of the screen, and it was there. And I asked people from the film festival and people about it. Why do they use the silver, and could this really be this screen? And everybody, you know, agreed that it had to have been the
And why original. Did they use the silver?
Because of the reflectivity of the light. I mean, it bounced so much more light for that, the whatever the film stock was with, you know, the limited
The silver screen. There's the word.
Yeah, and so because that's why I was thinking, well, this is the reason for that, why they called it the silver screen.
And you saw the light bouncing off from the door. Is that what you saw?
Just light hitting the edge of this curve in the wall, and just, you know, just like a trace. But it was a definite, you know, incised pattern. And of course, then I found the other four corners. In between, the walls had been broken and plastered over and smashed. But this was the original. And of course, I didn't know the origin of the word silver screen. I just knew it was, you know, associated with the films. But
how did that make you feel to find the vestiges of the truth of the history of the building being revealed ever?
Well, it was almost like, as you said, I mean, the building is talking, is speaking to you or something. And mm-hmm. and that moment when that light was just like that, and it was just the way the sun came through the side door, and the building was pretty dark inside. It revealed that, but I was so excited. I wanted to share it with somebody because I was like, to me, it was the discovery of the original identity of the building. And I think David Myers was coming by. I remember the cinematographer that. And I showed it to him because I said, you've got to tell me, do you think this is really the original thing? And he was, you know, he was amused by it. And it was, but it was like he wanted to just tell everybody. And
you spend a lot of time in that theater.
Yeah, I practically live in that theater.
I've been to your studio office, the ledge on the edge. with all the worlds you live in, Steve. It's almost an alternative reality. When I asked if you considered yourself an artist, you sort of challenged that thought. Yet, as we're conducting this interview, you've got your pencil box open, your sketch pad open. It's filled with remarkable sketches, and yet you don't really describe yourself as an artist.
Well, I guess because I don't do the traditional thing. I don't give myself, I mean, I draw obsessively, and that's all I want to do. That's an obsession. I don't know what that is. But I don't ever give myself permission to go and, you know, take a canvas and say, I'm going to do a painting or something. I never do that. People say, do you paint? And I don't. I paint scenery. That's all I do. It's always for some other purpose, or I guess.
So, to you, an artist is someone who
dedicates themselves to that, and they're constantly searching for a vision and for a, you know, something that their work takes them through a life process in discovering who they are through their art. And mine is more like just interpreting something that, in this case, it really relates to theater. Which of course is an art form, but it's
so we'll call it art light, shall we? If you're more comfortable.
Whatever.
Yet it's so funny because you're talking about someone that puts some idea onto a canvas. Well, your canvas is rather large as a theater, and also in the remarkable world you created at the Arts Festival last fall, it is not just, I mean, the canvas was the trees and the landscape, and then you brought into this wild, miniature, fantastical world that became a world unto its own within the beautiful art festival, within the landscape of the area, within Mill Valley, within Marin County, but it was utterly transformative. I mean, people were magnetically attracted to your display. And with all the details, shall we talk about that? The little people, the tiny world of cups and saucers and things off kilter and animals and flying things and...
Well, I don't... The fact that I haven't had any coffee makes it possible for me to speculate what that's about. I can't remember, but I've all my life I've been fascinated with this idea of the microcosm and the macrocosm or whatever. And why do we? I mean, even when I was a child, when I was escaping, I think when I was at Ed McGuire, when talking about how miserable that experience was, I probably had it easier compared to so many kids that much have had it way worse than I did. But even then, I would sort of lose myself in this imaginary thing of this, of dreaming of these little tiny worlds that, you know, I'd be out in there was a field where there was kind of, it was a grassy place that had kind of gotten, I guess it was actually part of the tract, and it was like flying over a continent to me, because you just walk over, you know, during the lunch period or something, when after you're just free to walk around or whatever. I imagine myself, you know, flying over these formations and exploring these valleys and things that were just, you know, way down, you know, hundreds of feet below. And that kind of thing, where you'd be out in the garden and you're playing with little tiny things and ants come and walk over them or something. And you know, you must have done
that.
Yes.
I mean, yes.
It's always that we have this genetically or something, this disposition to want to explore those little worlds. And I didn't, you know, I started doing it for the library years ago for the old display case up there.
Yes.
I would make the little mole stories and stuff for them. But that was just sort of one version. I did at different times. I sold my stuff through. I had a little gallery in the city that actually found me through the display case, and that's how I used to pay my rent and stuff. Just take things over there, and they just buy them, and I, you know, sell them afterwards or something. But I really was amazed during the art festival by the fact that I felt people really have a need for this. I mean, I thought nobody's going to want to see this. It's so boring. It's been done so many times before, and everybody's so used to the, you know, the high-tech films and things where you have these incredible, unbelievable worlds that are just so, you know, amazing. You can't even take it in. And this is so simple, but
it's
even
visceral, Steve. Yeah, you can get there. You can touch. It's three-dimensional.
Yeah, and it somehow takes you out of yourself for the moment. Because when I went down to look at the Grove there in the art festival, I would go there every few days before when I was getting the show ready, and try to draw those stumps, because there were whole worlds in those ancient redwoods that had been cut, you know, 150 years ago, and they had sculpted themselves into something unbelievable. I mean, these things that look like Monument Valley or whatever, I mean, and then little tiny worlds of
which you populated.
And then wanted to, yeah, because it was calling out for something like that. But I wanted to connect to that space, you know, and feel the presence of those, you know, the wise ones that were the ancient trees that were there and stuff.
Do you remember the Unknown Museum?
Yeah. But I didn't really get to know Mickey McGowan much until after that was gone. I went used to go to the one. He had one later, after that became Smith and Hawken. He started a smaller version in a house on. Did you ever go to that one on Blytel?
For those that are listening and don't know about the Unknown Museum, maybe you could describe it.
Oh God, I can't even begin to describe it. It's like
25 televisions with the screens smashed out and doll heads inside on the top of the roof, which is now Illuma Garden, the building next to. Tiny little obscure and gobs and so many things all glued together, spilling out of the entryway and onto the road. A micro world put on any number of things, a car, a stump, and a collection of junk that miraculously becomes an alternative world, and then in the process, art. That's what I remember. I remember the Unknown Museum being one of the most iconic parts of Mill Valley, and you could never go by without marveling at some bizarre, wonderful, confusing, brilliant. It really was quite an experience. And then when that closed, I mean, how it must have been to move all that stuff.
Well, he moved a lot into storage, and he had something in Sausalito in a postal building or something.
It's still there, I think. There's still some remnants.
There is. And then he did the one that I was telling you about on, the one on Blytel was the individual rooms were all sort of telling a story as you went through them. I mean, there was one that actually related to the Vietnam thing. It was that period, and the one about the bride or something, and I he would stand behind this little bar downstairs, like a cocktail bar, and give these wonderful dissertations or something that were just off the cuff it was about this world that he created and reflecting it against our world. But I, you know, when I went to, he used to open up his house in San Rafael for the one that's on right out towards the freeway. It's entirely full of collection, and the garden is full too. But he'll light it up one time, just before Christmas time, he'd go around and light all the rooms and all the things. And I noticed that there is something about his collection that it only encapsulates the time that he's been alive. I mean, it's a certain period. There's no ephemera or anything from before that. and it's sort of his lifetime, and so he's encapsulated all of America and all this stuff in telling a story through these discarded objects, and it's so fascinating to me. But I, you know, sometimes I've given him things, and I can tell if it's not really his era or something. It was a little too early or something, and mm-hmm. and just it's funny. But he doesn't talk about that.
His name again?
Mickey McGowan. And he was his friend. Well, at the time, I mean, he had lots of friends. But the other person that I knew from the Valley that did some of the work that you saw in there, like the I don't know if she did the horse, but she was a glue artist. Was Lois. Lois Anderson, who also worked at the library in mm-hmm. her last years. And she did phenomenal pieces that were, you know, like temples and, you know, she did take the Venus de Milo with a huge replica of her and completely do the glued on amazing creations. Undescribable.
How was that for you, seeing somebody? I mean, you are innately able to imagine a micro world filled with any number of little beings and the way it could be, you know, apart from the world you live in. And then you see his museums, who's somebody doing something similar, different. But I mean, did that affirm or affect you, or? Did you, you know, how was that for you, seeing that, and here in Mill Valley, because there aren't many places like that museum. That it was in Mill Valley is kind of interesting to me.
Yeah. Well, I think there are around the country, there are a lot of people that created their own world. I mean, there are books and books of people that are artists that have invented, you know, I mean, from the Watts Towers on, I mean, the people that just kind of started creating this way, but his is unique that it's it really is based on ephemera of, you know, like toys and, I mean, well, his house, he has like things like stacks of Bibles, so you can put your hand on the stack of Bible and swear and stuff like that. But he, and of course music, he must have millions and millions of records and things, but it's almost like it's to capture something of that time, and I'm not, mine is just sort of self-generated in a different way that it's sort of making up its own time. It's not
timeless. But I mean, the little animals and the little tea parties and the
but his is sort of, you know, it's more related to the Smithsonian in a sense, because he's really like taking America and putting it in a context that shows it somehow, so that you get messages from it. I mean, it mm-hmm. speaks to you, and it's not just objects. I mean, it's the way he's arranged them and carefully created these, you know, really brilliantly conceived imaginary worlds. But I was very much taken by his imagination and everything. But again, we're completely different kind of vision terms.
Have you ever found yourself getting lost in your world, in your little world?
Yeah, I think that's part of the necessity is that you have to, you really have to put yourself inside of it to make it work, to believe it's real. I mean, to some point, you know, that, but maybe I don't do it as effectively now as I did before, but yeah, I think so. Don't mm-hmm. we? I mean, that's the child part of ourselves that has to believe still that there's the possibility of that.
When you look back at your time in Mill Valley and with the theater, do you have any, I know you're still in process here, but do you have any observations or takeaways, you know, from maybe, you know, you grow up in an area and you kind of maybe, I don't know about you, but have a trajectory and expectation of how things may turn out, and then life shows you what really happens, and here you are so involved in our community, so much of a part of the creativity that, whether people know it or not, that we all enjoy and appreciate and depend on here in town through the Throckmorton Theater and the other theaters and that we have, music halls, Do you have, I mean, how now you're a person of a certain age, how do you feel about how things have turned out for you?
Oh, God, I never think about it. I just, you know, think about what I'm working on or something. I don't know. I do notice when I'm in the theater, when somebody comes to visit and we're just sort of showing people around and stuff, and I'm like, oh my God, I mean, it's like I've touched every wall in this place. I've touched every, there are just too many things. I mean, it's too obsessive. I mean, I have to pull back some point and let go more. I don't know what, but it's the problem because the theater becomes, you know, there's storage for, you know, why is that puppet theater upstairs, for instance, or the camel or whatever, you know? Well, there's just no other place to put it. So it just gets, there's this stuff all over the place that's sort of generated by this, you know, there's a kind of creative dynamo that keeps producing, because all I do is, that's my, the spine of my character is just to create. It doesn't,
at
some point, it doesn't mean anything. It's just, you just have to be doing it, and then that's the only meaning there is, or something, for me. But no, I don't know. I guess most of the theaters I worked in the city were all, I knew they were pretty ephemeral, and they would, you know, they weren't going to be there forever, or that people would change them ultimately into other things and stuff, but I hope this one lasts for a while. I think the biggest thing for me has been able to partner with Lucy. I mean, she has a magnetic imagination that just is in, how do I, you say, describe somebody who's living in the world as it should be, the you know, the dream of the possible world where the interrelationship of the parts and the people is no longer based on a, you know, like a you know, a capitalist model or whatever, you know, the hard system that we still live in. It's way beyond that. Her generosity and her just the breadth of her vision is really in another, the future, the world that it should become, that we want to become. And I just, to partner with, to work with her is to get to share in that perspective. And even though I'll never be able to live up to it, but it's just, it's so rare in my lifetime. I mean, this is probably the only person I've ever met with this kind of a gift.
Well, she certainly is a visionary, and so are you, Steve.
No.
So I just want to thank you for sharing your story today, sharing your life and your experiences and your worlds and your creative, the creative dynamo that you are, and making our community, you know, that just that much more interesting and inspiring. I know you're in the day-to-day of your work, and that's where you live, but we, on the outside of that, we really get a lot out of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I feel like, you know, all along, it's not, I'm not doing anything. I'm just doing, and it's, whatever it is comes through me, it's not me. It's like, so I'm just an instrument or whatever.
Oh, we're grateful for the creative process and for the creative reality of a lovely little town filled with so much possibility, the things that are going on, and the vision of the of what, you know, because here in Mill Valley, there's a lot of talk about that small town feeling being gone, and the way that culture has changed and people being pulled apart from each other through technology. But that's exactly not what's happening at the theater.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an enclave of the, of you know, a place where that's protected, that kind of community involvement and interaction is protected. And that's the beauty of art too.
Mm-hmm.
And the vision that Lucy has, which she is helped in, as she's mentioned, with the collaboration with you, is precious. So thank you very much. I think we've said it all, huh?
Yeah, thank you for asking me. I mean, this is... I'm sorry I can't think about these in more depth. I it's just like I'm just saying what comes to the top of my head.
Well, that's what we're here for.
I don't know what you mean.
That's what we're here for. So on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Public Library, we'll conclude this interview. And I'll see you at the theater.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.